Welcome to episode 44 of the Intermittent Fasting Podcast. If you want to burn fat, gain energy, and enhance your health by changing when you eat, not what you eat, with no calorie counting, then this show is for you. I'm Melanie Avalon, author of What, When, Wine, Lose Weight and Feel Great with Paleo-Style Meals, Intermittent Fasting, and Wine. And I'm here with my co-host, Jen Stevens, author of Delay, Don't Deny, Living an Intermittent Fasting Lifestyle. For more on us, check out ifpodcast.com, melanieavalon.com, and jenstevens.com. Please remember, the thoughts and opinions on this podcast do not constitute medical advice or treatment. So, pour yourself a cup of black coffee, a mug of tea, or even a glass of wine, if it's that time, and get ready for the Intermittent Fasting Podcast. Okay, friends. People often ask me, what is the one supplement I cannot imagine my life without? And while there are a lot of supplements out there, a lot of ones that I love, a lot of ones that I advocate, there is one supplement that inspired me to create a whole supplement line. And that's because I take it every single day and I really can't imagine my life without it. That would be Serapeptase. And I'm about to tell you how to get up to 15% off on a special bottle version that we have that also saves you money. So Serapeptase is a proteolytic enzyme created by the Japanese silkworm. Now we make it in a lab, so it is vegan. When you take this enzyme in the fasted state, it actually goes into your bloodstream and it breaks down problematic proteins in your body. These are things that your immune system is often reacting to and that create inflammation. That's why it can do incredible, amazing things like clear your sinuses. That's why I first started taking it. You can completely say goodbye to allergy meds with Serapeptase. It reduces inflammation and pain. My friend just started taking it for her back pain and told me she was shocked at how effective it was, more so than the pain pills she normally was taking. It can help reduce cholesterol. It's even been shown in clinical studies to break down amyloid plaque in vitro and in vivo. Basically, it is a wonder supplement. And what's super cool about it is that it specifically breaks down those problematic non-living proteins. It doesn't harm healthy tissue. It actually helps protect that. That's because the function of the original enzyme in the silkworm is to break down the cocoon of the silkworm without actually harming the silkworm itself. And there aren't studies on this, but I really believe it can help catalyze your fast by enhancing the natural process of autophagy. Again, not studies on that, but from a mechanistic standpoint, it totally makes sense. Here's the thing. I was taking so many different brands of Serapeptase, and they always seemed a little hard on my stomach and have problematic ingredients in them, especially special enteric coatings where they wouldn't disclose what that was made of, which meant it probably contained problematic plastics. I knew I needed to make a change. That's why I created my Avalon X Serapeptase. It's what launched my Avalon X line. I will never stop taking it. It's one of my favorite things in my life, and the effects I experience are profound, and I hear that from all of you guys as well. We test it multiple times for purity and potency. It's free of all problematic fillers and common allergens. It comes in a glass bottle to help prevent leaching of plastics into ourselves and the environment. And we even use the minimum amount of stickiness in the label on the bottle to help reduce problematic compounds. So if you want to tackle your inflammation, clear your brain fog, oh, it's amazing for brain fog, stop your allergies, attack amyloid plaque, reduce pain, so many things, you need Serapeptase. And you can get 10% off with the coupon code Melanie Avalon. But here's another thing. We actually have a special large bottle. It's the only supplement that we have right now in a large bottle. It's the 180 version and it saves you money. If Serapeptase is a part of your daily life, like it is mine, you definitely want our large bottle size, 180 capsules. It's the best way to save. And again, you can save even more with my Melanie Avalon 10% discount, or you can get 15% off that as well if you get a subscription, which by the way, with a subscription, you could pause or cancel anytime after your first order. So it kind of makes sense to do a subscription because you save even more. If you want a supplement that you can actually feel the difference, I promise you, Serapeptase is the way to go. And then you might end up like me and want to give it as gifts to everybody because it's that incredible and can address so many issues. You can get this at avalonx.us. That's AVALONX.US. Again, there is the 90 capsule size and the 180 capsule size. You save more with the 180. Use the coupon code Melanie Avalon for 10% off or get a subscription for 15% off. And we will put all this information in the show notes.
One more thing before we jump in. Did you know that common ingredients found in skincare and makeup products can actually disrupt your endocrine system? These endocrine disruptors are a silent threat that can have significant impact on your health, including something that is very important to me, fertility. Your skin is your body's largest organ, and what you put on it matters. Endocrine disruptors are chemicals that interfere with the natural hormonal communication in the body. It also matters during pregnancy, and that's one of the reasons I pay close attention to what I put on my skin while being pregnant. Studies have shown that exposure to endocrine disruptors can affect both male and female fertility. For women, these disruptors can lead to irregular menstrual cycles, ovulation issues, and even polycystic ovarian syndrome, or PCOS. In men, they can reduce sperm quality and quantity, making it even more challenging to conceive. But it's not just about fertility. When it comes to fat loss, one of the reasons that endocrine disruptors can get in the way of fat loss is because a lot of our toxins are actually stored in our fat. It's a way that our bodies protect us from those toxins. These toxic compounds can even work synergistically, amplifying their harmful effects and making it that much harder to shed unwanted body fat. All of these reasons are why I am obsessed with a company called Beauty Counter. The founder actually started the company when she learned about the potential dangers of toxic chemicals and their link to health issues, specifically miscarriages and infertility. While pregnant, I make sure to only use Beauty Counter products. It's one of the only makeup lines that is officially recommended from the Environmental Working Group. What really sets Beauty Counter apart is their unwavering commitment to protecting us, the consumers, from the hidden dangers that lurk in conventional beauty products. Beauty Counter goes above and beyond, rigorously screening every single ingredient that goes into their products, ensuring that they are safe, clean, and free from harmful toxins. They're not just a beauty brand, they're a movement for change, advocating for stronger regulations in the beauty industry. With Beauty Counter, I know that I can trust that the skincare and makeup that I use are not only effective, but also safe for me and my family. They have skincare lines for every skin type, as well as so many other incredible products. I absolutely love their overnight resurfacing peel. It's my favorite way to get anti-aging benefits in a skincare product. The makeup is absolutely amazing. I have tried alternative beauty products in the past and none of them truly performed. But with Beauty Counter, the foundation is so amazing. It makes me feel like my skin can breathe and it looks so dewy and beautiful. You can shop with me at beautycounter.com/VanessaSpina. New customers can use the code CLEANFORALL20 for 20% off their first order. Beautycounter.com/VanessaSpina. All right, friends, now back to the show.
Hi, everybody, and welcome. This is episode number 44 of the Intermittent Fasting Podcast. I'm Melanie Avalon, and I'm here with Jen Stevens.
Hi, everybody.
And I sort of know the answer to this, Jen, but how are you today, Jen?
Well, I feel great, but my voice is scratchy. So everybody just bear with me. I'm a little scratchy. We have had like sickness going through our school like crazy. We had 19 staff members out one day and there's like no subs to go around because everybody in the whole county is sick. So just a little scratchy throat, but I feel fabulous. So anyway, if I sound weird, that's why.
And we just learned that honey is a quick fix for...
I had a spoonful of honey and it helped a lot, so...
You could just chow down on honey the whole time that we record.
There you
go.
We'll
be on a sugar high at the end.
Yeah, so if I start to get, you know, like rambly at the end, y'all know why.
I wish Manuka honey was more affordable because I see a huge difference using Manuka honey versus other honeys. Like, huge. But it's so expensive.
I think I had it. I've had that one before. But now I just always use a local honey, a local raw honey.
Yeah, I like those. But I think they flare my candida. And they, I don't know. The Manuka is just amazing. But it costs so much.
Doesn't it have a little bit of a different kind of flavor too?
Yeah, it's a different active component that makes it.
Right.
So most honeys are... It's because of they generate hydrogen peroxide, basically, so they're very antibacterial. Manuka honey has something called non-hydrogen peroxide activity. It's, it has another compound that's only in Manuka honey, and it is crazy in how antibacterial it is.
Yeah.
They did a study, and it knocked out every single pathogen and virus and bacteria that they tried. Every single one.
Wow. Yeah, it's been a while since I read anything about it, but I remember reading about it, and that's why I ended up with it at one point. But I think it had a really strong taste.
Yeah, it does. I like the taste, but I think I probably have spent like $1,000 in Manuka honey, so I should stop. It's that expensive.
Wow.
Hi. All right.
Well, how are you doing?
I'm good. Still in my apartment in Venice. I'm excited to move again in April, I think. So I think it'll just be so nice to be settled somewhere.
Oh, yeah. It makes a big difference.
I think it's going to make a huge difference just for stress levels and just everything.
Well, it'll be here before you know it. Yeah, time flies.
I know. So I've just been working on my storage unit, which is crazy. But
we accumulate a lot of stuff, don't we?
Yes. Random little quote. I was listening to another Rhonda Patrick podcast, the one where she interviews Dr. Walter Longo. That was a really good episode, so I definitely recommend that for listeners. He made a very interesting comment about fasting. They were talking about whether or not fasting was stressful, and he said that in his opinion, fasting is actually less stressful and eating is more stressful, because eating puts you in a weaker position while fasting actually makes you stronger, which I thought was interesting. All right, so shall we jump in to everything for today?
Yes, let's get started.
We're thrilled to bring you Health IQ as the very first sponsor of the Intermittent Fasting Podcast. Health IQ is a life insurance agency rather than a broker, which uses science and data to secure lower rates on life insurance for health-conscious people, like our intermittent fasting listeners. They can give our listeners exclusive rates, but you have to qualify by taking their online lifestyle quizzes based on everything from the metabolism to the paleo diet to, and I'm not making this up, people who like wearable weights like me. They personally guide you all throughout the life insurance process to make it easy and even fun. To see if you qualify, you can get your free quote today at healthiq.com/fasting. Or you can mention the promo code FASTING when you talk to a Health IQ agent. Totally check them out. We think you'll love them.
Our first email came from Anne, and her subject is the Weird Problems episode, part one. So I love that she's already listened to the first Weird Problems episode. And Anne said, "Hi, Melanie. Thank you so much for your podcast. Love it. I learned something helpful in each episode. I just listened to your Weird Problems episode and thought you might be interested in this. I am a registered dietitian and did a paper on maple syrup urine disease while I was in school. It is a rare metabolic disease caused by the lack of enzymes that are necessary to break down branched chain amino acids. These substances build up in the blood, spill into the urine, and cause the weird sweet odor that gives it its name. So there you go. Keep up the good work, Anne."
Hi, Anne. I love that. I love that we now know. So you were right. You were spot on with your maple.
I thought so. Yeah, I remember reading that because it like stuck with me. It was a weird problem in the book too. The guy that had it. That's how they identified the killer, by his weird maple syrup smell.
That's so funny.
I think they also had like maple syrup sweat.
Oh, wow.
Too, yeah. So that's what I remember.
Well, if they built up in the blood, maybe it – oh, yeah, because she says caused the weird sweet odor, so.
Right. So funny.
Crazy. Well, thanks for that, Anne. And then we have one more little feedback type email. This comes from Lorette, and subject is stand-up desk. And she said, "Hi, ladies, really quick question for you. You mentioned using a specific changing table on top of a desk to stand up and work, I think. I remember hearing it in an episode, but I can't seem to find it now. And I looked in stuff we like and didn't see it there either. Would you mind refreshing my memory on what it was that you mentioned? Really love your podcast. Thank you, Lorette. And I included this because I think it's just such a great hack for standing desks, because standing desks are so expensive. But what I use is, yes, it's a diaper changing table from IKEA, and it's just perfect for as a standing desk. And it's like $70 or I don't know. It was 70 when I bought it. I think it's more now. But I will put a link on Stuff We Like to it, because it's a great hack for standing desks, because why spend more when you can spend less?
Yeah, that's a good height, because that's where you'd be changing your baby, right?
This is true. All righty. Time for the questions.
Yes. We have one from Erin, and the subject is flavored electronic vaporizers. Now, she also has another question we're saving for next week, but we're going to start with this one. So Erin says, I am a new listener to your podcast and new to the fasting process. I just listened to episodes 4 and 5, which now have me wondering if the flavoring in the liquid of an e-cigarette would cause an insulin spike or possibly break my fasting time.
Yeah, so I did a little bit of research on the ingredients in e-cigarettes, and they typically include water, propylene glycol, which is not the best, vegetable glycerin, flavoring, and nicotine. So the flavors, you can't ever really find what's in them, like anywhere. It's all like proprietary. So I don't know about those. And then we talked in a previous podcast about how nicotine actually can affect blood sugar levels. So that could possibly be a thing. According to the official diabetes like association, they just basically said that there's not any strong clinical evidence on – or sorry, there's not any strong clinical studies on the effect of e-cigarettes on blood sugar levels for people with diabetes. So the debate is out there.
Yeah. Of course, we worry not about what it does to the blood sugar, but what it does with the insulin. So that's what I would worry about. You know, when they're calling them flavors, your brain is not smart enough to say, hey, this is an e-cigarette. She's not eating cotton candy. You know, I think that's like a flavor that they have, you know, cotton candy.
I looked up the link and there was like 50 flavors and they looked really yummy.
Yeah. Well, see, we've talked about this off and on in the Facebook support groups, and it's just one of those things. I mean, they call them flavors. So if we're trying to avoid flavor and would use the word yummy, that's, you know, if you're, that sounds delicious, then I think that that would answer your question. So I would recommend to avoid them. I have actually had members say that they noticed a difference. You can get like an unflavored variety or something, ones that are not sweet. I'm not an expert on that, because I'd never used an e-cigarette, but I think that you can get something that does not have a sweet flavor if you want to.
Maybe if there's like minty flavors.
Yeah, if it was only minty with nothing sweet at all, that would be a better choice. Then, I mean, you definitely wouldn't think that something, you know, cotton candy or grape flavored or, you know, something that is going to mimic a sweet food is going to be more likely to cause a problem.
Right.
Yeah. It just makes sense with the theory. We don't have, you know, data on that, but if you go with the whole sweet taste spiking insulin idea, then this is a sweet taste. So I wish we could say, no, not a problem. But it's hard to trick that brain and those responses that occur.
Alrighty. So our next question or questions comes from Paige, and the subject is actually 4 IF questions. And we're going to do 3 of them, and we're going to save one for next week. So Paige says, hi, Jen and Melanie. Love your podcast. Enough said. Me, I've been clean fasting 8 to 20 hours a day since early November with a few days off for vacation. I like to say I practice Jen's approach with a splash of Melanie. I love that, by the way.
Yeah, I do too.
It's so great. So her first question, she says, food sensitivity, not allergy tests. Which one do you recommend to start with? There are several send us your spit and we'll send back your result tests advertised on the internet. Is one more legit than another? And I will start just to clarify. So for this question, the difference between food sensitivities and food allergies. So food allergies are IgE immune responses, and they're more immediate and they're more severe. And they're basically the like an allergic response of the immune system. So that is compared to IgG, which is it's more like a food sensitivity marker. It's actually debated about how accurate it is. It's a more of a delayed response of the immune system to certain foods and allergens. And the reason it's debated is because some people and some research say that rather than it being a marker of an allergic response, that it's a marker of just what you are constantly exposed to. So if you're eating like a ton of one food, you might have an IgG response without it actually being an allergy. But then some people say that it is indicative of like immune problems. There are a lot of companies out there, Paige. The one I used recently was identallergy.com, and I was really happy with it, so I can recommend it. And I will say that it's often on Groupon, and there are other companies often on Groupon. So before you go straight to the website and buy it, check Groupon, because you can usually get a pretty good deal on those.
That's a great tip. I have no recommendation. I told Melanie a minute ago, I don't know of one. I would just be, you know, basing it on their pretty websites, and because I don't have any experience with those companies. So, you know, if you could find somebody who did an unbiased review of them, that would be the best. Or someone who's tried them, you know, and some reviews, that would probably be the way I would go if I were looking for a company. And one of those is right here from Melanie. So
yes, well, I know that you can. I did an allergy. I was happy. That was a hair test, actually.
Okay.
Not a spit test.
Not a saliva.
But there are spit ones as well.
Hi, friends. So I'm sort of haunted by clothes. If you follow me on Instagram, you probably know that I love wearing all the new clothes all the time. And I know that that is not really sustainable and not good for the planet. That's why I am thrilled that there is now a way to get all of the clothes with none of the waste. And I'm going to tell you how you can get unlimited clothes with no waste for a month for free. That's right, I now have a website for both myself and you guys where you can get free unlimited clothes with free shipping, free exchanges, nonstop from all of the hottest brands, and it is so incredibly easy. It's called MelanieAvalon'sCloset.com. We have so many incredible brands, including my favorites like BCBG, Calvin Klein, and so many more. Think like 100 brands. There are so many options. And the way it works is when you get a subscription, you search through the clothes, pick what you want. They send it to you with fast, easy shipping. You wear it as long as you want. And then when you're ready for more clothes, you just drop it off in their prepackaged envelope and get your next round. It is so incredibly cool. They have multiple plans. The starter plan gives you two pieces at a time. Friends, I actually have a little secret hacked. Don't tell them that I told you this. When you get your two pieces, you can actually immediately go into your account, click return, and they'll go ahead and send you the next two pieces. So technically, you can have four pieces at a time. You also have a cool virtual closet that you can keep stocked with everything you eventually want to order, so you never miss out. And if you really like something and want to keep it, you can opt to buy it at a massively discounted price. Friends, I'm obsessed. This is finally the answer to wearing all the clothes all the time with none of the waste. Oh, and of course, one of my major reservations was the cleaning compounds that they use on the clothes, because yes, it is dry cleaning, which normally makes me nervous, and they don't say this on the website, so I reached out to them, and I was like, hey, what's going on with the cleaning? What do you guys use? Because I can't promote this if it's just normal dry cleaning. And thankfully, they let me know that they do not use any detergents, fabric softeners, or chemicals that are harsh. Everything is professionally dry cleaned or laundered with detergents that are free from dyes and scents. It's all gentle and it uses low temperature cycles. So yes, we are good on that front as well. It is the coolest thing ever. And you can try it free for a month. Yes, completely free. Just go to MelanieAvalon'sCloset.com to sign up. free clothes for a month. After that, their plans are super affordable. We're talking, honestly, an entire month is less than the cost of typically what would be the cost of one dress. And I am not kidding. That's right. Unlimited clothes for less than the cost of one outfit. I'm just so thrilled to bring this resource to you guys. I can't wait to hear what you guys think. So again, get free unlimited clothes for a month at MelanieAvalonsCloset.com. That's MelanieAvalonsCloset.com for all of the clothes, none of the waste. And definitely share your pictures and tag me on Instagram because I want to see all the fabulous things that you guys are wearing. That's MelanieAvalonsCloset.com.
All right, so her second question, she says, several people have mentioned they fast Monday through Friday, but not on the weekends. Will that ruin the progress towards becoming a fat burner or just hinder it a bit? Will Monday be like starting over? I just wrote, you're all good. I don't see any problem with it if it's working for you. I mean, I guess you can go completely crazy on the weekend. It's a very individual. It really depends where right. you are and how crazy you're going and where you want to be. And I don't think we can make a blanket statement that it's automatically going to ruin your progress. It's really just a matter of if it works for you. What are your thoughts, Jen?
Well, you know, there are fasting protocols 4-3 and 5-2 where you like for 5-2, you have two fast days a week and five, quote, eat normal days. That actually worked for me very well for maintenance in the summer of 2015. I did 5-2 because I hadn't gotten really sold yet on the daily eating window. I guess it might be because I was not clean fasting. So fasting was a little more of a struggle back then. But 5-2 worked very well for me for maintenance. And to lose weight, I could lose weight on 4-3, which was three fasting days a week, and then the four, quote, regular eating days. So you're just going to have to see how it goes for you. If you are able to make the progress you're looking for and, you know, quote, take weekends off, then you'll know. But if you find, you know, every Monday you get on the scale and your weight is like back up, and then by the time Friday rolls around, it's back down, but then Monday it's back up again, you know, then you'll know it's not working for you. So instead of thinking about taking like the whole weekend off, maybe just consider having a wider window on one of those days to go with your social events. And, you know, that may be more of a maintenance lifestyle than a weight loss lifestyle. Like, I'm pretty sure that I could maintain taking the weekends off. I would not because I don't feel as well when I do. One other part of the question that Paige asked was, would this ruin the progress towards becoming a fat burner? And I'm going to go back to my own experiences over the holidays when I ate more than I was used to on Christmas Eve and then all day on Christmas Day. And then the next day, the day after Christmas, I did find I was more lethargic. I think I was I had replenished some of my glycogen stores. So I did not have that feeling of ketosis and energy and fat burning that I normally have. So now that I'm very in tune with my body, I do notice that it takes me a while to get back into the swing of things after some luxurious time off for the holidays or for a trip. So, or indulgent time, that might be a better way of putting it. So if you have those more indulgent weekends, you may drag through Monday. You'll notice that. And then, you know, I don't want to feel like that every Monday. So I don't think I would want to take all the weekends off. But you just have to figure it out so that it works best for you and that it feels like a lifestyle. Because it's not a good lifestyle if you always feel like it's keeping you from doing what you want to do. Right? You got to make it work for you.
Excellent point. All right. And then her last question, she says, Melanie, one time you mentioned carrageenan. Is that how you say it?
I would say it like that. Yeah. I don't know. I've never said it.
Could you please tell us what is the deal with carrageenan? I often see it listed as an ingredient. I hear it isn't good, but I'm not sure why. Everyone mentions our foods are full of this and full of that without stating the specifics. Thank you for pointing out carrageenan. Could you and Jen please pick a few of the top worst offending unnatural ingredients out there and talk about them? What are your top recommended additives to avoid? So Jen, do you want me to explain what carrageenan is?
Sure. Go ahead.
So it is a polysaccharide extracted from red seaweed. And it's used for gelling, thickening, stabilizing. And so you might be thinking, oh, seaweed, natural.
Healthy, right?
Healthy. Yeah. I mean,
and you find it in a lot of dairy products.
Yeah, yeah, you do.
Like you know, sour cream and things like that.
And ice creams and things like that. But it's not the best thing ever. It actually can be pretty destructive for the digestive system and can trigger an immune response. And I found this fascinating. So tons of studies where they're testing drugs, they use carrageenan to cause inflammation.
Oh, wow.
To then test the drug to see if it is an anti-inflammatory.
Wow. You know, that makes me wonder if a lot of people who think they have trouble with dairy actually have trouble with this ingredient.
It's very possible. Yeah. Or with the other additives and things like that. Found like quite a few studies. It's a known activator of inflammation in mammals. It has been shown to in mice to produce glucose intolerance, insulin resistance, impaired insulin signaling, and other animal models have shown inflammation of the colon. So basically, it's just not good. And the fact that they're using it to cause inflammation is just not good.
Yeah.
What are some of your favorite, non-favorite additives, Jen?
Well, you know, when my boys were little, one of my sons had had chemical sensitivities. And so he was very, very sensitive to anything artificial flavors, colors, preservatives, MSG, things like that. So I had to become very good at reading labels at that point. He couldn't have any of that, or it would actually cause him to have a behavioral reaction. You know, and as a teacher, I had seen kids with obviously behavior reactions, you know, my whole teaching career, but I didn't really understand the connection between what we eat and behavior. Like, this was a whole new world to me. And his preschool teacher actually said, you know, some days this boy is different. This is my son. I don't want to say his name because I don't want to embarrass him if he ever hears it, but one of my boys. And she said, could it be what he's eating on those days? And so I started to research, and I found that there is indeed a link in many kids with some of these artificial flavors, colors, preservatives, MSG, and then, you know, what goes on in their brains. Linus Pauling wrote about it. He's the guy who got the Nobel Prize for his work, I guess, with vitamin C. He talked about, they were calling it, quote, like brain allergies, I think. So it acts on the brain in a way that, like, I mean, we know chemicals act on the brain. You know, you drink alcohol, it affects your brain. You take drugs, it affects your brain. So food can do that too. So I've always been, ever since I learned this, I've been a little skeptical of any kind of artificial flavors, colors, preservatives, things like that. And so I try really hard to buy things. When I'm reading the labels, I pick the one with the fewest ingredients. I mean, there's not like one thing that if I see it, I'll be like, no, I'm not going to have that. But I try to choose things that have, you know, I would pick a sour cream that did not have, you know, the carrageenan in it versus one that did. It's pretty easy. You just read the side-by-side labels. So I'm not listing anything specific, just in general. Go to the most real food that you can. And can I tell a really quick story about somebody in our Facebook group?
Yes.
You know, we're all baking this homemade bread now. And it's so much fun to watch everybody get excited about baking bread because it only has yeast, water, salt, and then whatever kind of flour you want to use. I'm using an organic flour. But one of the husbands of one of the group members, I mean, we have a lot of husband and wife people who are fasting together, but one of the husbands posted today about how he is like literally going to town on bread, but he does not have the reaction to this homemade bread that he had to store-bought bread. Like, he had to eliminate bread. He's not been able to eat it. But his wife's homemade bread is not causing him to have any of the problems. So it's apparently something that they're adding to the commercial bread that's giving him the problem.
It's very, very telling.
Yeah.
A recent hypothesis is that for depression could be seen as inflammation of the brain, and a mechanism of it for some people may be reactions to certain foods, which causes inflammation in the brain.
Well, you know, your body releases all these different chemicals, and that makes your brain, you know, respond. So food can certainly do that. Even like chemical smells can do that. Like, he had a lot of trouble with any big strong odor that was super duper, you know, artificial. Like, don't spray Lysol around them. That was a huge problem. You know, they're toxins. It just made him, he just acted nuts. And you could just see it. It was like a light switch was turned on.
Yeah, it's crazy. And so I know, Paige, you wanted like specific things. So I'll tell you, I will tell you some specific things and specific problems. So actually, quick fun fact, there's actually more than 3,000 food additives in the U.S., and many of them are actually banned in other countries.
Yep. That's telling, right? I mean, that...
Pretty telling.
Yeah.
So, for example, BPA and propylene glycol, which we actually talked about earlier with the cigarettes, those can be hormone disruptors. BHA and artificial colors are also hormone disruptors and can be carcinogens. Bromine and BHT can encourage hypothyroidism and organ damage. Also pay attention for like partially hydrogenated vegetable oils and things like that, as well as trans fats. All of those oils and fats are just really, really bad for the body because they're fats. So the body's interpreting it as a food and something to build from, but they are not in the natural form which supports our body. And so then it creates like cellular foundations of inflammation, and it's just not good. So yeah, I mean, if I had to like pick top ones, I mean, all of them. food dyes have been linked to a lot of things as well. Rather than picking, oh, what's the worst one, I would just say, if you can, avoid all of it. I mean.
Flavors, colors, and preservatives. I think that's what all that was. Yeah, all those. And they're tricky because, like, I learned, for example, you know, we find vanilla, right? Vanilla is a flavor that we're looking for. Well, they've made an artificial form of it, and it's vanillin. It looks like vanilla, but they add an N to the end of it, and it's the fake one. So you just look at it and you're like, oh, look at there. That's just fancy vanilla. No, it's not.
It's almost whenever I'm looking for ingredients or like food, like vanilla extract, for example, or anything really, I always turn it over with bated breath. And I feel like 80% of the time it has additives that are just no good.
Just get it as close to the actual food as you possibly can. And again, I don't want anybody to be like paralyzed with fear and afraid to eat, because you're going to sometimes have these things in foods that you're eating. And the key is, when you have a choice, choose one without it.
Definitely. Especially when you're shopping, because you have the power there. But yeah, then she also said, this isn't a question, but a tip for Melanie. Keep your Redmond salt near the pineapple. If you salt your pineapple right before you eat it, you'll prevent the mouth sores. Thank you for the podcast. That's a great little tip. I'll have to try that, Paige.
Great tip.
I stopped eating pineapple for a little bit, and now I've started again, and yep, the mouth sores are back. So might have to
put some salt on there. This.
I love my Redmond salt anyway, so.
Report back. You. Let us know if that worked.
I will.
All right, well, let's go on to Catherine's question. And her subject is resistant starch. And this is one I love. Catherine says, kudos to two fabulous ladies and their equally fabulous podcast. Can you take maybe 5 to 10 minutes to just do a rundown of the studies about resistant starch, particularly given the latest cook, cool, reheat thing? I've been so happy to add carbs back to my diet, and this sounds like an intriguing way to make them even better for me. But I'd like to understand, to the extent possible, what the research really shows and what the underlying mechanism is understood to be. Thanks, and keep those podcasts coming. Then we also have a combo question. This is from Rosie, and her subject was also resistant starch. And Rosie, we answered another question from, but this is the second part of her question, and it says, can you please discuss the benefits of incorporating resistant starch into our diets, how to do it, and share any experiences you personally have with resistant starch? All right, Melanie, you want to get started with that one?
Sure. So thank you so much, Catherine and Rosie. Hi again, Rosie. We answered her question about, what was her question about? Rosie was the one who asked about the 5 tips for breaking through a plateau. So this was her other question. Yeah, so resistant starch. It is basically a type of starch that isn't broken down and absorbed in our small intestine. So it moves to the large intestine, and there it serves as a substrate, a fuel substrate for our intestinal bacteria in our large intestine. And so they can munch on it and create short chain fatty acids, which can fuel the colon, support intestinal health. So it's basically starch that we, our intestinal cells, can't absorb, but the bacteria can if it makes its way down far enough. So there's actually four types of resistant starch. First type, found in whole foods. So that's in like whole grains and legumes. And it's literally physically entrapped in like a compound that we can't digest. So we just can't digest it. There's the second type is ungelatinized starch. And so that's found in raw potatoes and high amylose corn starch. So for this type of resistant starch, the more raw the food is, the higher this form of starch. Because when we cook it, we actually make it digestible. So like raw potatoes, this is not the cooked and reheating, but just straight up like raw potatoes, they're going to have this type two. So type three is the type that people talk about a lot on the interwebs. It's that the cooked and cooled thing. So that actually happens when starches undergo a process called retrogradation. And so basically you cook the food and then you cool it, and then its cooled state, it has resistant starch. And this actually includes potatoes as well. Rice is another one that will do this. So yeah, most people do the potatoes or the rice. They don't actually label resistant starch on in foods. But if you ever see something called high maize products, that's like the commercialized label for resistant starch, which is interesting.
Can I share something about the potato real quick? This will help listeners understand. You know, think about a baked potato. When you've just baked a potato and it's really, really fluffy, right? It's hot, it's fluffy, you're putting your butter on there. Now I would like to eat a baked potato. That sounds delicious. But imagine now that you let your potato sit until it gets cool. You will never get that fluffy texture back again, no matter what you do to it. It is unfluffed. And that is what we mean by resistant starch. It actually changes the structure of the potato from that fluffy, fluffy, starchy potato into this unfluffy resistant starch. So if you just picture that cooled off baked potato that's never going to be fluffy again, you're going to have to turn it into twice baked potatoes, which are also delicious. That'll help you understand how the starch has actually changed.
So two things about that. Okay. So basically for the potato, so it has three stages. It has stage one when it's raw, right, and that's going to be the second type of resistant starch that we can't access. Then we cook it and everything's like accessible. So say goodbye to resistant starch. And then if it cools again, we have a new form, right, of resistant starch. It's not the same as the way it was originally, but it's
when it was raw. Yeah, it changes. It actually changes the structure.
Yeah, but it's still a resistant starch. And then I'm so glad you said that, Jen, because that made me, I meant to mention this in the beginning, I just, when you said that, I was like, where did I just hear that? Because I just read your book, Feast Without Fear.
Oh, yay.
I'm sorry. Sorry it took me so long. It's been like so crazy.
Well, you've been a little busy. But, I get it.
But yeah, and you talked about that in the book, and I thought that was a great analogy. And for listeners, everybody should get that book. It was wonderful.
Yay. I'm glad that you liked it.
What I really love the best, I think, is how you go into, like, with the studies. You bring up the study and then you really break it down and you really go through it. And I think that's something that's missing in a lot of books that I read today, because it's really rare that the author literally escorts you through the studies. They're kind of just like, this study said this, this study said that.
And then you go and you look at the study and it doesn't say that at all. That's what I found in so many books. I mean, that literally will make you angry listeners, do this. Read a diet book and look at a study that someone has like quoted. You go look at that study and see if it really says what they said it said. And you're going to be shocked. You're going to say, that is not what this study says at all. So I was like,
it's crazy.
It really is crazy. People take a lot of liberties in their books with what the studies say.
It's like, because I know when I was writing my the longest blog post I've ever written, which was a critique and an analysis of What the Health, the documentary. And I had to like read, I would like, they would reference a study and I would pull up the study and would read it. And then I would just stare at the screen and be like, am I reading this wrong? Like, because this is not what,
right?
This is not what they said. Because like, yeah.
It's shocking, really. And I guess they assume you're not going to look or that you'll just take their word for it or maybe that you don't have access to it. But, you know, in this era, and of course I'm married to a college professor who has access to literally every study that you can get because his university has a medical school. So, you know, not everybody can actually find the original studies, but I have a supplier.
And even the studies themselves, depending on who they're funded by and what they're trying to prove, they will definitely cherry pick and draw the conclusion will be like completely not related to what they found.
Exactly.
It'll be like one little tiny piece that may or may not be indicative of even what they found.
And then the headlines of all the news reporters saying, look what this study found. And then that's not what it found at all. You know?
Yeah.
It's fascinating when you start getting into the – and I have a whole chapter on this too about scientific studies and can we trust them. And
yeah, that was something else I really liked.
And by the way, we just had our science fair at my school.
Oh, nice.
You know, I talked about that in Feast Without Fear about the kids and their science experiments. So I looked around with fresh eyes this year and the airplane experiments are always there. So,
oh, yes. Yeah. I liked that. So listeners, definitely check that out. I literally felt like I could have written most of it. I only had one tiny, tiny little critique.
Uh-oh, what was that?
Just that there were not like in general, everything was amazing. And I think you did an amazing job. And I agree with like pretty much everything you said. But just that there was an absence of any studies showing problems with grains.
Well, I'm not showing problems with anything. I think grains are great. I think grains are part of a healthy diet. So why would I put studies in there showing that they weren't? Because you could find studies showing anything is a problem if you look. Because they take a tiny component of it, and maybe that's causing a problem, but maybe that's not the actual problem in your body that we need to be worrying about. So, yeah, see, I'm not afraid of grains. I feast on grains without fear every single day, so.
Yeah, I guess for me, I guess, because they've had recent studies showing that, like, gliadin found in grains create intestinal permeability. And this is a very recent study.
Yeah, you are not going to get me off a team grain. Sorry.
Oh, I know. I'm just going to say where I'm coming from.
Yeah.
Like, because there was a recent study showing that gliadin, for example, found in grains causes intestinal permeability in every single type of person, not even just those with celiac disease. Even if it's like, quote, silent, like people don't experience the effects. And I talk about this a lot in my book. In addition to that, grains have opioid-type compounds, which can potentially mask the negative effects that you might be feeling. I guess just because I come from a thesis where I think that grains are a major instigator of degenerative disease. I completely understand, though, that grains work for a lot of people. I would just have put like one sentence saying.
Well, yeah, but that, I don't think that there's any one food that is like that. I mean, I think there are foods that don't work for people, but I don't think there's any one food like you feel about grains that.
Well, I guess like with protein, you said that like, you know, some people think too much is bad. Some people think, you know, less is better. So I would have just had like.
Well, I was lumping it in with the carbs. I talked about carbs.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it fits in with that. Like,
no,
people
I'm not. I'm not trying to critique you. I'm just saying. I'm just saying the whole...
there was a no chance I was going to say don't eat grains.
Oh, I don't want you to say don't eat grains. I was just saying, out of all in the whole book, I would have put one sentence. That's all. That's all I'm saying. Kind of like with like alcohol, you would say that. With the protein, you'd say that. With the carbs, I would have just said that with the grains too. That's all. And you said it with the dairy.
All right. Well, thank you for the feedback, and I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah. I did. And listeners, yeah, definitely get it. It's an amazing book. Great for cultivating a mindset of not having fear around food, and just it was wonderful.
And the whole point being that our bodies are so different, and you've got to figure out what works for your body, and that you actually have the ability to know that from the way that you feel. And that's, I think, we take so many recommendations from people who don't live in our bodies, and we think that that's how we have to be. And when really, we know our bodies are smart. We know what foods make us feel bad, especially with the intermittent fasting. I think that gives us, we've talked about this before, you're better able to tune in to what works and what doesn't.
Yes. Yeah. No, definitely.
Yeah.
So it was wonderful. Oh, and I will say, so I originally wrote like a long review of the book on Amazon, and I said that I was the co-host of the podcast, and I said that this is my like honest review, and I basically said everything I just said to you right now, and Amazon was like, no, you can't post this.
That's so funny.
I was like where did the review go? I was talking to Jen because I was like, they haven't posted my review, and then like 4 days later they were like, sorry, this is not
approved.
You have to change it.
Oh.
So I took out all mentions of me, but my name is still there. So
all right. Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Of course.
Did you have anything else that you wanted to add about the resistant starches? I have a little bit I'd like to say.
Oh, yeah. So let me just to wrap that up. So then there's a fourth type, and that's a completely like chemically generated resistant starch. That's often found in processed foods. And that's typically the form where I talked about like when it's called high maize things, that's often the fourth version. As far as the studies go, for people without too much gut dysbiosis, there are debates about resistant starch, but in general, the studies tend to show improved gut health for most people. I'll just do a rundown of some of the things I found. Like, it can increase the good bacteria in our large intestine. It can stimulate blood flow. It can help us absorb other nutrients. It can potentially inhibit other pathogenic bacteria. Make you feel full. Help with insulin sensitivity, digestion. Just basically a lot of good stuff. That said, of course, I'll give my caveat that I always give, that if you do struggle with digestion problems, resistant starch might not be the best for you. It's really an individual thing, and you have to see if it works for you. So start slow, start low is what I would recommend, and then you can add more and more if you respond favorably to it. I just know for me, I've not done well with it in the past, but some people do great with it, and that can also change because you're gut microbiome is always changing, so it's definitely something to experiment with. What are your thoughts, Jen?
Yeah, I think you hit. I'm trying to figure out what you haven't said that I had written down. We talked about how, or you said that it's broken down in your bacteria or in your intestines to short chain fatty acids. And one thing that I know about that is that these short chain fatty acids are also linked to satiety hormones. So, you know, people who do well with the resistant starch find that the resistant starch helps them to be satisfied with their foods. And I think that's my biggest plus with including these foods in my diet. When I was trying to do keto and trying to do low carb, I never felt satiety. But when I added back carbs, including resistant starch, you know, I eat a lot of beans, things like that. It just makes me feel full and satisfied. And so those short chain fatty acids are linked to the release of those hormones. So that's a good thing. Also, one thing I wanted to mention that is great with resistant starch, you know, if you're if you're trying to control your blood glucose or you know, if you have type 2 diabetes or whatever, you monitor your blood glucose spikes. You know, there's even something happening now. It's a trend called eat to the meter. Have we talked about this, Melanie? Eating
no,
to the
I don't
meter.
Think so.
Okay, people are and this is based on the research that everyone has a different glycemic response, and we've talked about this on the podcast, I know, and it's even and that's also in Feast Without Fear. You know, maybe rice makes you have more of a glycemic response than it makes me. So people are actually
And it's in my book too. We talked about
okay.
We did both. We both did talk at length about that same study.
Okay. Okay. So basically, resistant starch does not break down and get in, and so it doesn't. It's not released into our blood sugar like it would, because it's not released in the same way it goes down to our intestines where it's broken down. So it's not going to cause us to have as much of an insulin response. So your cooked and cooled potato is going to have a different insulin response to your fluffy, hot from the oven baked potato. So that's just something to keep in mind. So people who are doing the eat to the meter strategy, they'll eat something and then see how their blood glucose responds, with the whole goal being to keep it low. And that's how you can know what foods are working well for you and what foods are not. You know, I'm not about to start doing that personally, but for people who are already monitoring their blood glucose for because they're diabetic, this is just a great strategy. And, you know, see if you notice a difference with the different foods.
Do you measure your blood glucose?
I don't. No, I don't. Now, I have a friend. He's a Facebook friend. He's actually maybe an emergency room doctor, maybe in Canada, I think. And he does a lot of self-experimentation. And he was actually using one of those new blood glucose monitors that gives you, like, it's a continual. Have you seen those, Melanie?
I want one so bad.
I know. Okay, I do want that.
You have to get them implanted, though, right?
No, it's a sensor. It's not implanted.
Oh.
You stick the sensor on your skin, and it continually sends the feedback.
Can you buy it, or do you have to
you
have
can.
Like, a doctor?
I think you have to have a prescription, but he's been using it in Canada, and I know it's available here now, but, you know, I have no interest in pricking my finger and taking my blood sample all day long, but a continuous blood glucose monitor would just be very interesting. You know, do you need to do that? No, but I love data, and it would be fascinating to see, you know, how my blood glucose went up and down depending on what I was eating. It's just fascinating. I bet one day I'll get one of those, but they've just been released. I think the price is high, and I'm not even sure if you can get them without a prescription.
I was actually going to test mine right now. I test mine a lot. That's how I know that I get really hypoglycemic. Well, I know because the way I feel.
Right. Yeah, that's the thing with me. I know, like, for example, if I had a cookie to open my window, I know that my blood sugar crashes because I can feel it. So when you're in tune with your body and you're used to being in the fasted state, you know what your body's doing. But it would still be interesting to see what would happen after certain foods.
I mean, it could be based on what I eat, and I so rarely eat straight up, like, foods high in glucose. Like, I typically eat protein, fat, and then a lot of fruit, which the fructose-glucose ratio of fruit tends to fill liver glycogen and not really spike insulin. So whenever I test after meals, I'm always, like, lower than before I started eating, which is a problem I'm trying to address because it doesn't keep me full as long.
Right.
But then I don't feel good if I eat, like, more carby stuff. So I don't know. It's a puzzle. I'm really on the fence right now because I want to buy either the ketone breath meter, or there's a new blood ketone meter called Keto Mojo or something, and it tests your ketones, your blood glucose, and your HbA1c, I think. But I'm just on the fence about whether or not the breath versus the blood, which is more accurate.
Oh, the breath is not more accurate. You want the blood.
I mean, I guess I know that, but I guess let me rephrase. I'm on the fence about whether or not the breath is accurate enough.
Right. I would not even waste my time with that. Just because, you know, when you have been in ketosis for a long time and your body is used to it, your body doesn't waste as many of the ketones by, you know, sending them out in your breath. So you actually, the longer you are fat adapted and in ketosis and all of that, the less you may be excreting. So the blood level is really going to be your best bet.
So I think, I'll probably get the blood one. So yeah. Like my blood sugar right now in the moment is like 84. That's good, right? I mean, that's okay,
I don't know.
Right?
It sounds like it. Yeah.
I know come nighttime, right before I eat, it's always without fail, 79, always.
Yeah.
And then I eat and then it's like 70. And I'm like, that's a problem. Probably. I don't know.
Well, your body is releasing insulin in response to the food that you ate, and it brings down your blood glucose.
Yeah, like it's supposed to. I think my pancreas kind of overreacts because I don't think I should be lower blood sugar after eating then.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not an expert on what your blood sugar should do because I don't measure it. So
I'm obsessed with measuring things. I'm going to get that meter. Okay, sorry. Back to the question. So yeah, so resistant starch, definitely something to play around with, see how it affects you. And something else, it really is crazy how fast the gut microbiome can change in relationship to things. Resistant starch can probably do this as well, which is why I bring that up. But for example, you know VSL number 3, Jen?
No.
It's like the probiotic. It's prescription. Versions of it are prescription. Other versions aren't. But it's like the probiotic that all the tests study. And it has most probiotics that you buy in the store have around, maybe like 1 billion, 2 billion, 3 billion bacteria.
Uh-huh.
This one, it starts at, the pills have like 100 billion.
Wow.
The sachet has 450 billion. And then the double strength prescription one, which I got a prescription for, has double that. So I guess like 900 billion bacteria. I started taking it. I got a prescription for it. And my, not to get TMI, but my bowel activity completely changed, like completely overnight. I actually stopped because it kind of freaked me out.
Something was happening down there.
Yeah, I think I'm happier with less bacteria in my system.
Okay.
Maybe
that means you actually need more, though. Maybe you need more. Maybe that's a big part of your healing journey is having more.
That's a whole debate, and it's something I literally research every – and when I say I research it every night
– yeah, I believe it.
I research it every night. Every night. It's an obsession, and it's a problem. And that's why I love Dr. Ruscio, because he talks about – both versions, and his book is coming out February 15th, and I can't wait. And he said he's going to talk about this a lot in the book. So excited.
Well, good. What's his book called?
It's called Healthy Gut, Healthy You.
Okay.
I am so excited. Gut health is key.
It really is.
I don't think we'll ever have a podcast where it doesn't come up at some...
No. And, you know, I think you mentioned this with Catherine's question about if she wants to know about adding back in the resistant starch. She's adding the carbs back in. And my only recommendation, I think Melanie touched on this. It was a while ago in our conversation, but add things back in slowly. Melanie mentioned that. But especially when you're adding back in carbs, if you've been avoiding them, expect to see weight get quote gain unquote on the scale. And that is what freaks people out, because when you eat carbs, it comes along with water retention. So people are like, oh my gosh, I can't eat carbs and my weight just balloons. Well, it's not going to like balloon forever. It just has that pop of water weight. And then, you know, you can go from there. So just be cautious and be aware that that's going to happen. That's why when people begin a low-carb diet, they usually – like the first – I think the rule of thumb is like 4 pounds. Like your first 4 pounds are like water weight that you lose. You didn't just lose, 4 pounds of fat. But then also, if you go off of it, your first 4 pounds that you gain back are also not fat.
You know what's interesting though?
What?
To that point. So I've been listening to – this week and next week is the first keto FX. So it's like paleo FX, but it's keto specific. And it's a lot of online interviews with people about keto. I've been loving it because it's giving all different perspectives. And as you know, I keep trying to do keto and keep failing. Still on that journey. one of the speakers, and I don't know if I agree with this, but I'd never heard this concept before. She said that sometimes when people are keto and then they are like super low carb and then they add back in carbs, that they can lose water weight because
the body has to process the water. Yeah.
Yeah. And she said that that could create the whoosh effect because the body has
to, well, that's true.
The body has to process the carbs. So it pulls the water from the cells, which I'd never heard. It was the complete opposite of what I've always.
The theory of the whole whoosh effect is that your body is holding the water in your fat cells as like a placeholder as you're losing fat. So what would happen is then your body would pull that water out really fast to use to process the carbs and then release it. So yeah, we actually hear that a lot in the Facebook groups with people who like all have, they're on a plateau and they're feeling super squishy, which is what of course happens right before the whoosh effect. Their fat cells feel actually squishy to the touch, like their belly might be really squishy feeling. And they'll have like a big blowout meal or like take a day off, and then they'll find that stimulates the whoosh effect. So yeah, that actually is something that anecdotally we hear all the time. So like if someone's on a plateau, frequently people will suggest, you know, take a day off of intermittent fasting and see if that helps. But
so if you're super low carb and then you add back in the carbs, you could potentially have one of two completely different responses.
But it's all water is the whole point. You're not gaining or losing really fast. So if you have a really quick change of weight in either direction, it is not fat. And people freak out. And they're like, oh my gosh, I ate all weekend and I gained 7 pounds. No, you did not. It's water. It's the food. It's all of it in there together. So our body does a lot with that water.
Well, we don't really have time for anything else.
I don't think we do. I think all of our other questions would take too long. We had some very interesting conversations, though.
We did. And I will say, we're starting to get like really good questions. I mean, we've always been getting really good questions, but we're starting to get, I feel like listeners have listened to a lot of our episodes and they know what's been asked. And we're starting to get a lot of questions
that are sophisticated, like sophisticated questions.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Like they're very specific. Like they're things I haven't thought about addressing. Like I would never even think about addressing. So lots of good stuff in the future. There's like so many. We could do like a 5-hour podcast. No, let's not.
Let's not.
Okay.
People would like that though, right?
They probably would. Alrighty. So a few things before we go. You can go to ifpodcast.com/episode44. And that's where we'll put all the show notes for today's episodes. So that's where we're going to put all the references for all the studies that we discussed and any other relevant notes. You can also go to ifpodcast.com/stuffwelike. That's where we put all the stuff we like. So for example, the stand-up desk, I'll add Dr. Ruscio's book. It's not even out yet, but I'm sure I'm going to like it. All of the things, and that page has everything that we've ever talked about on the podcast of things we like. So it's a treasure trove. And also, if you're in iTunes, you can subscribe to our podcast, and that's where you will get the podcast downloaded automatically. Also, when you're in iTunes, if you'd like to write just the briefest of reviews, we would appreciate that so much. It helps. It really just really helps. You can also write reviews of our book. That really helps too. I don't like begging for reviews, but my publisher's like, you need to get more reviews for your book. So if anybody wants to help out there, that would be awesome. And any final thoughts from you today, Jen?
No, I think we got into some very interesting stuff today. As usual, we always do.
I know. I really enjoy our conversations.
Yeah.
Alrighty. Well, I will talk to you next week. I hope you hope your voice.
Yeah, me too. Since I have to go back to work with the kids, it usually does. That doesn't help. So.
Oh yeah, no kidding. No kidding. All right. Well, feel better.
Thank you. Have a great week.
Talk to you next week. Oh, and listeners get really excited about next week because it's
coffee. Yay!
It's all the coffees. I probably shouldn't even say that because people are going to try to send in questions for it. You can if you want. we might answer them. we already have like 50 questions, yeah. Is why I say
coffee
that.
Is very, very near and dear to us.
If you have any really, really random questions about coffee, send them.
Yeah.
And we'll try to get to them.
Okay. That's a good one.
Yeah. Alrighty. Well, I'll talk to you next week.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye. Thank you so much for listening to the Intermittent Fasting Podcast. Please remember, the opinions we discussed on this show do not constitute medical advice. We're not doctors. Check out ifpodcast.com for more information on us. Theme music was composed by Leland Cox. See you next week.